I realized that I've been listening to some of my audio recordings, and I've noticed that every one of my audio recordings begins with the word "so," including this one, which is what reminded me that that's the case, because I audio record the lectures that I do at the university for a variety of reasons, and they all began "so." And then I noticed that all these lectures that I'm, or whatever these are that I'm doing here, they all begin "so." So, there you go. This weekend, some of us were in Yakima to hear Zatshoji teaching, and it was really interesting that. The theme that I've been wanting to work with this fall is the theme of interconnectedness or dependent arising, or there are different ways to translate the Buddhist concept, but basically it's how everything connects with everything else and how that fits into our meditation practice and how that fits into life. So I understand that from the point of view, as I said, of meditation practice, and that's part of the way I want to develop in our own conversations here. So guess what Zatshoji was talking about? Interconnectedness, dependent arising, and how that fits into meditation practice. And I thought, gee, I guess he and I are connected. So that's really nice. So I'm actually going to pick up this theme with I'm going to piggyback a little bit on what he was talking about and sort of move forward from there. So, Carolyn, I apologize a little bit for that. And Kay, I apologize a little bit for that. But anyway, so the idea of interconnectedness seems simple and straightforward, I think, if we just think about it, or dependent arising, which is the way Buddhists talk about causation, seems pretty straightforward. Doesn't seem like a big deal. But the concept actually is not so much that it's elastic, but depending upon the context in which you think about it, or utilize it, or contemplate it, it actually has deeper and deeper and deeper meanings. Sort of like the example, I think I gave this example a couple, 3 weeks ago when we met, about turtles all the way down. You know, there's this native idea that the earth is seated on a tortoise shell. And Gary Snyder, the poet, was mentioning this in some poems that he was reading from his book Turtle Island, because that's the native idea. This is Turtle Island. It's an island supported on turtles. Someone said, well, what's underneath the turtle? What supports the turtles? And he says, turtles all the way down. So the thing is, I like that metaphor because when we think about interdependence, it can get subtler and subtler and subtler and have richer and richer meanings if we put it in different kinds of contexts. And in general, that's sort of the theme that I want to work with. So tonight, the place I want to begin, though, is to quote something out of one of the old Buddhist sutras, which Zatshoji referenced and was actually a main theme of his teachings this weekend. And this is a story of something that happened early in Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching career, when he was sort of wandering around and he wasn't really very well known as a great master. He didn't have, you know, scores and scores and hundreds and thousands of disciples and this sort of thing. And it's a story about one of his main disciples, ultimately one of his main disciples, called Shariputra, and how Shariputra ends up becoming a disciple of Buddha. And the way the story goes, as Zatshoji was telling it, which is kind of nice, is Shariputra had become himself a famous teacher in ancient India, the Buddha's time, and he had hundreds of students. He was a great intellectual, and so as an intellectual, he was able to attract a lot of students. And he obviously had a lot of spiritual virtues also, because mere intellectual is not going to attract spiritual students, especially not in the ancient world. You have to display some special qualities But so he must have had those qualities, although what those qualities might have been is not necessarily so clear. Anyway, he's passing through this town and he sees this monk, but at that time probably the right word would be more like a renunciate. And I think his name was Ajata. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Does that sound correct? Ajata? Something like Ajata. Anyway.
It started with a D. Oh, no.
No, right. No. It was something Ajata. Like Ajata. Yes. Anyway, Shariputra sees this monk, who, as it turns out, is one of the original five disciples of the Buddha, which Sacchaji didn't mention. You remember the story that they're the five ascetics who rejected the Buddha just before his enlightenment because he had, in seeking the middle way, he had actually stopped fasting. And then when the Buddha traveled to Varanasi, on the way to Varanasi, he meets them actually at Sarnath, which is outside of Varanasi. And they realize that something's happened, and he teaches them, his old companions, and they go, oh, he's got it. Okay, we'll become your students. So his first five students were his old colleagues, if you will. So Shariputra meets one of them. What he sees is that this person is very elegant in all of his movements and very calm and very present and very noble as he's moving through the community, perhaps begging, and as the way he walks and sits, and his general bearing is noble and calm and this kind of thing. So he thinks, wow, there's something really amazing here. So he asks him about how did he achieve this. He says, well, I'm a disciple of the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, and I followed his way, and that's what you're seeing here. And so Shariputra says, well, I don't know who this person is. So what is his thing? What's his shtick? What does he teach? What is it that you learned from him that was such a big deal? And so this is recorded, actually, in one of the old sutras, and it's a meditation theme, but I'm not going to so much use it that way, but I want to share with you what's in the sutra. And so what this student, Ajata something, says to Shariputra is that this is what we've learned from the Buddha. Of those things that arise from a cause, the Tathagata, that means the Buddha, has told the cause, and also what their cessation is. This is the doctrine of the great recluse, another epithet for the Buddha. And Shariputra kind of wakes up when he hears this. He has an awakening. And you think, what? You know, how do you have an awakening just hearing that? That didn't sound like a big deal teaching. But it's the teaching of dependent arising. And in fact, so when he says, all things have a cause, and the Buddha has taught the causes of things and also how those things cease, basically, this is a way of formulating the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths are usually formulated in regards to suffering, which is there's a cause of suffering, and this is the cause of suffering. And because suffering has a cause, it also has a method of being extinguished, of ending. And the path, the Eightfold Path, is the way to bring about the end of it. In other words, if something has a cause, if you remove that cause, then you remove the effect. And if the effect is suffering, if you remove the cause, then the suffering goes away. Well, most of us don't think too much about suffering. You know, in the ancient world, people thought about it a whole lot more, I guess. Although maybe we should. I have two friends who've just been diagnosed with cancer. So thinking about suffering is something that I think about very much these days, because one of my friends has pancreatic cancer, and he has between 3 months and a year, and it's not going to be pleasant, you know. So I'm thinking about these things, but you know, mostly we don't think about that. But we do think about other things that are problems for us. But the point is, really, what was the big deal? So I've always felt that there was something hidden here that was not so obvious. There's another place in the sutras where the Buddha says, if you see dependent arising, you see me. And when you see me, you see dependent arising, which is causality or interconnectedness. These are different ways of translating the same term. So what's the big deal? You know, it doesn't sound like a big deal to us, but I think that the big deal is that there's something subtler that is going on with this concept, depending upon the situation in which you apply it. So one of the Buddha's teachings, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to start working through those different levels of subtlety over the next several weeks, starting with the basics, which is the Buddha taught something about the human condition by way of explaining how his path worked. And he taught about the five skandhas, which is looking at human experience in its fundamental aspects. And if you look at human experience in its fundamental aspects, you find basically what we would call five categories of experience, and that the things in those five categories are pretty radically different from each other. And there's nothing in experience that's not included in those categories. So there's nothing that's outside of those categories. And one of those categories is perhaps what we would consider the most important thing, which is consciousness, the fact that we're aware in some respect of what's going on. And another one of those categories is that we have a physical body. And if you think about this, the physical body and consciousness are two sort of phenomena which are radically different from each other. I mean, one is material and one is non-material. You can point to one, but you can't really point to the other. We believe we have it. We all believe we're conscious and we're aware, but we don't really understand too much of what that is. We think we understand it until we start looking at it really closely, and then it's not entirely so clear. There's for example, there's an old Zen story. I mean, the Zen tradition made up stuff about the early patriarchs, to be honest. But the stuff they made up is still informative and interesting. And so there's a story about the first patriarch, which is Bodhidharma, who was supposed to have brought Zen to China. And his main student, who is the second patriarch, so it's through them that the lineage of Zen is supposed to have been passed. And this second patriarch goes to Bodhidharma and asks to have his mind pacified. Or maybe it was the third patriarch goes to the second. It doesn't really make any difference which one it is. One of the patriarchs goes to another one and says, I want to pacify my mind. Can you help me to make my mind peaceful? And so the teacher, either the first or the second patriarch, says to either the second or the third patriarch, however it worked out, because my memory sucks at this point, but it was one or the other, says, well, okay, I'll tell you what. Go off and meditate for a while and find your mind and bring it to me, and when you bring it to me, I'll pacify it for you. And so the student says, sure, fine, I'll go ahead and do that. And then he comes back after some period of time, and the teacher says, okay, well, and the student says, I was looking for my mind, but I couldn't find it. And he said, then the teacher says, great, see, I pacified it for you. It's like, that's the way the story goes. Well, there's obviously, again, something very deeper in that than is referenced in the story. But my point is simply that when we look for our mind or we look for our consciousness, it's actually pretty hard to find. We think we know what it is and what it does. That when we try to identify consciousness, it's actually pretty hard. And the way we end up identifying it is by noticing that we don't have it when we're sound asleep. That's one way of recognizing. Like, I woke up this morning and I noticed the birds singing. And until I woke up, I'm sure the birds were singing, but I didn't notice them. So now I know what it is to be aware, you know, and what it is to not be aware. And we understand the one by understanding the other. But other than doing it that way, it's very hard to identify because it's sort of there all the time. But we think it's really important, and we know we have it. People are always talking about that. But to be specific about it is a problem. And in fact, there are something called the TED Talks, which I may have referenced here, which are these very interesting short talks that you can visit on the internet with some very creative and interesting people talking about them. And they're curated, and so you get some really fine speakers, and they're well-funded. So you get people who are willing to come and take the time. And so one of the TED Talks is some leading neuropsychologist, physiological psychologist, something like that, a woman for some super prominent university, And there are questions from the audience that come at the end. And so at the end, someone asks her something about, okay, well, you told us all about brain function and everything else. So what about consciousness? And she says, oh, that's the hard problem. Right. So this is this leading edge, super brilliant physiologist, physiological psychologist, something like that. Yeah, that's the hard problem. And so then the questioner says, well, okay, so what does that mean? He says, well, I can't answer the question. She says, I can't answer the question. And then this person says, well, do you think you're going to be able to in some time? And she says, well, maybe in 20 or 30 years, or maybe not, who knows? This is the hard problem. That's the reason they call it the hard problem. So, I mean, it's elusive even to leading-edge scientists when you really get down to it. But one of the things the Buddhists have said is that it is there and it does matter, but it also has a relationship to the material body. And we all accept that that's the case, but when we look at what that is, where do we find it? And the place where we find it, one place where we find it is in perception. Because, I mean, we're all educated and we know that when we see something, for example, like this teacup, we know that what's happening is that my eye is registering light that's bouncing off the teacup, and somehow my awareness is forming an image, which is teacup, that we know that an external object in some way, whether we say it's the light or the object that's reflecting the light, and our eye, our physical organ, and our awareness, our consciousness, are coming together in a perception. And we know that because if we close our eyes, we can't see anything. It's not a big deal. I mean, that's one of the things that's interesting about our ability to close our eyes, which we can't really do with our ears. We can't close our ears and make the sound go away. But we do have the ability to close our eyes, and suddenly there's no sight anymore because effectively our eyes aren't functioning. So we know how the sense organs work. We can extrapolate from that to all the other sense organs. And we know that there is something unique happening when the sense organ, consciousness, and the object come together, which is different than the mere fact of there being a body and the mere fact of there being consciousness. And then in the skanda system, there are two other things that they talk about which are unique, which is the fact that we're attracted to or repelled by things, which is different. It's categorically different than perception or consciousness or matter. It's some kind of an inclination that we have. We like things or we dislike things, or we're neutral about things. And there's no fourth possibility. I mean, we either like things, we don't like things, or we're neutral. I mean, you could say, well, I sort of like it. But that's like saying you're sort of a little bit pregnant. I mean, you either are or you aren't. You either like it, you don't like it, or you're neutral about it. It's in that space, one of those three spaces. There's no fourth possibility. And the last one is something called habits or predispositions. And Zhaozhuji likes to talk about energy, but I'm not going to go there. But it's like, you know, we have these habits, we have these tendencies. And we could say that that's actually what drives liking or disliking things. But yet it's different than liking or disliking, because habits are laid down by past experience in many cases. And there are other things that cause habits. But that's not the point. The point is, if we look at the process of perception, we see interdependence or dependent arising, because we see that the experience of perception requires that three things come together that depend on each other in order to have a perception: a sense organ, an external object of some type, and consciousness. That those three things depend on each other in order for there to be a perception. If any one of them is missing, there's no perception. So Kay's 50th birthday, we went to Carlsbad Caverns, and one of the things that's really interesting in Carlsbad Caverns is when they turn off the lights, it's dark. Not like dark in any other form of experience you've ever had, but as in zip, total dark. I mean, nothing. Nothing whatsoever. Unless there's some little girl and they're wearing those little shoes that you know, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, generally speaking, it's totally black. And so what happens is something's missing. And it's like the object is missing at that point, and therefore there's no consciousness of sight. Your eyes function perfectly well. Your consciousness is conjoined with your eyes perfectly well. But there's no light bouncing off any physical object to hit the retina to begin to form an image in some way. Something's missing. These three things have to come together for there to be a perception. Now, if you really check that experience out closely, however, you can notice that your eyes begin to create some sort of static equivalent of light, because they're used to the idea of something happening, I guess. And it's like they're static in the system, and you start seeing little things flickering around. It doesn't take long before your eyes start filling in that space. A better example of this is tinnitus, which I have a very severe case of. Tinnitus is the ringing in the ears that many people have. Well, what my ear, nose, and throat specialist tells me about tinnitus is as the nerves, as the auditory nerves age and elements of the auditory nerves die off, there's sound that you can't hear, but your brain wants to hear that sound, so it makes it up, and that's what tinnitus is. It makes up that noise that's not actually out there in the world. It makes it up. So what's the point that I'm trying to make here? The point that I'm trying to make here is that in meditation, you can begin contemplating the way in which all phenomena in our experience are interdependent by looking closely at the perceptual process. So if you're sitting cross-legged and you're doing your basic meditation in the morning, whatever that is, if there's a point that you want to do this, you can be very quiet and you can just look at what the nature of your experience is. And you'll notice that in your internal experience, things depend on each other. Things are interconnected. Nothing exists in isolation. Now, to really get at this, if you're sitting and meditating, I mean, one of the things that I like to do in the morning when I'm having my coffee is I sit there on the couch cross-legged and I look at that marble plate on the wall, which I got in India. And I like to look at that because it's round. So round things tend to hold your attention and it's natural. You know, it's not plastic or artificial in some way. So it's very soothing to my eye. And I'll do that. And when I do that, I can notice, and you can notice, the three things coming together in the experience. You can notice that you're aware of the plate. I notice that I'm aware of the plate. And you can become aware of awareness in that way. And you can do this with anything, you know. If you start looking at the perceptual process and thinking about the fact that you're aware of what you're looking at, thinking about the fact that you're aware of what you're hearing, like I'm aware that I hear my tinnitus ringing in my ears, or thinking about the fact that you're aware that your knees hurt because you're sitting, or your back is stiff, or your butt hurts, or whatever the case may be, so that you're aware of the experience of the proprioceptive or kinesthetic experience, or if you smell something, you're aware of smelling something, okay? If you think about that, you can notice awareness. You can start noticing awareness. You can start noticing consciousness. But of course, what that implies is that there's two parts of you that are doing this, that there's a consciousness of consciousness. And as soon as you realize that, what you're realizing is that you are watching a complex process, which has been described by Buddhists in different ways, of awareness being aware of awareness. Awareness being aware of awareness. And it's a momentary phenomenon, because pretty soon what will happen is you'll have some thought or some fantasy that will distract you, and off you go. You know, so you need to pull your mind back from that fantasy or that sore knee or whatever the case may be. And one of the ways you can do that is by thinking, oh, I just got distracted by that thought. So then I became aware of that thought. Now I'm aware of that awareness, and suddenly you're back to aware of awareness. And you just do that kind of thing over and over and over again. And you can kind of begin to hang out in that space of just awareness in relationship to awareness, or consciousness in relationship to consciousness. And the way you get there is by understanding intellectually, first off, how things depend on each other, and then looking at how things depend on each other. And as you do that, and spend all your time looking at how things depend on each other, you begin to find yourself sort of seated, if you will, in this pure awareness. Now, I think, to loop back to the original story about Shariputra and Ajata, whatever his name was, I think that because these people were already serious meditators when they met each other, right, that Shariputra understood immediately what this teaching was about. It wasn't just about the cessation of suffering. Of course it was that. But that's not even the way it was phrased in the story. It was phrased as interdependence. Everything depends on everything else. There are causes, and things can cease. And what the Buddha teaches is the way everything connects with everything. And I suspect very deeply that Shariputra immediately saw the implications of this as a core teaching, because he'd been meditating, and he understood what it meant, and he just saw directly with his own wisdom. Because the Buddhist tradition also is about cultivation of wisdom, cultivation of compassion. And that relates to this also, because this quality of being aware of awareness, this quality of understanding how the perceptual process works, and watching how the perceptual process works, and experiencing how the perceptual process works, is part of what is meant by wisdom, Buddhist wisdom. And it's liberating, right? It's liberating to not be yanked around by our own mental dramas. I mean, you know, it's sort of like you get yanked off into the fantasy, but if you work with this practice long enough, you know, you start pulling yourself back from that, getting yanked off by it more and more quickly and more easily. And you seat yourself in this very peaceful place more and more easily, more and more frequently. And that's sort of the virtue of all of this, because whether we are really concerned about the suffering of the world and escaping suffering in the way in which the Buddha taught or not, I think pretty much everybody would like to have a little bit of peace of mind. It would be, you know, comforting every once in a while to be able to take a kind of mental vacation without having to pull the cork on a wine bottle, or, you know, immerse oneself in television or a novel, or even walking down the street and enjoying the fall. There's a different kind of peace, which is this kind of inner peace, and that you can kind of step into this inner peace through this process. So I'm going to continue to talk about this over the next couple sessions, but that's pretty much what I wanted to say today. Unless you have questions about it, that's pretty much it.
Can you do that one more time?
Yes, of course. Yes. Yeah, I got this. I think this is authoritative. There are different ways of translating it. So, Carolyn, you'll recognize that this isn't quite the way Zajidje translated it. But there are no, you know, there are no solid English ways of translating the Pali or the Tibetan. It's kind of interpretable. But this is the translation I found. Of those things that arise from a cause, of those things that arise from a cause, the Tathagata has told the cause. Of those things that arise from a cause, the Tathagata has told the cause. And also what their cessation is. So of those things that arise from a cause, the Tathagata has identified both the cause and how they cease, how they come about and how they cease. This is the
Shakyamuni.
That aligns somehow with the Four Nobles.
Right, because the Four Noble Truths is boiled down in the simplest formulation, suffering.
The acquisition of, or
the source of suffering, the cessation of suffering. So that's truth 1, 2, and 3, and the path to bring about the cessation of suffering. That's usually considered the core teaching. But the way the Tibetans talk about this is that really the core teaching is at a level underneath that, because what he's talking about is he's talking about the source of suffering. That means the cause of suffering. And if he's talking about the cause of suffering, he's talking about suffering as the effect of a cause. And so what he's saying is, if anything has a cause and you don't like what that thing is, then you remove the cause and that thing goes away. That's the end of suffering. So it's really a teaching about causality. The way Buddhists like to talk about causality, though, is we say cause and effect. We say this is the cause and that's the effect. That's the way Westerners talk about things. But the way Buddhists talk about things, which is interestingly different, is here's the effect. What does it depend on? And the difference is, if we say cause to effect, we say this one thing leads to that one thing. But if we say, here is the effect, what does it depend on? It could have multiple things that it depends on. So it kind of opens things up. And that's actually more realistic if you think about it. Because when anything happens, there are multiple reasons that thing happened. For example, I had a flat tire up at Morgan Lake today. So you could say, by Western way of thinking about things, maybe this is more than you wanted to know, but say the Western way of thinking about things is, my flat tire was caused by the nail in my tire. But from the Buddhist way of thinking about things, what did the flat tire depend on? Well, it didn't just depend on the nail. It depended upon the fact that I wanted to be at Morgan Lake because the weather was so beautiful. If the weather hadn't been beautiful, I wouldn't have been up there to get the flat tire. So it wasn't just the nail that was involved in it. It was also the beautiful weather. Yeah. Right? And then you can go a little farther with it and say, well, the flat tire depends upon other things. Sunday, if it had been a work day, it wouldn't have mattered if the weather was beautiful. Right? So now the flat tire can be seen to depend not just on the nail and on the beautiful weather, but also the fact of it being Sunday. Right? And so you can go on this way, and you can see very complex chains of how things relate to each other. And it's much more realistic, and it opens things up in ways that the Western way of thinking, when you just say cause and effect, too simplistic.
Yeah, I remember... Something that really had an impact on me was that when my previous husband was going through the dying process, it was like there was a lot of talk about karma, and it was kind of a new age kind of way of thinking about karma, which was, you know, well, what was the cause, one cause for this cancer to, you know, to manifest. And that's just really an unhealthy way to think about things, you know.
Sometimes you wonder.
It brings in all sorts of stuff like that. And one of the things that one of our teachers said was that there was infinite numbers of causes that arise with every moment. So, you know, you can't, and when you think that, maybe, like you're saying, David, it just opens everything up. So, and of course, thinking about it from the past life kind of perspective too, that there's infinite causes, you know, that come forward from, you know, previous lives, interactions with people, interactions with the environment, the universe. I mean, it's, you know, so I don't know. I've always found that was a really helpful, you know, way to think about things. That infinite numbers of causes that cause every moment to arise.
It makes me think of the Matrix.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, and came, you know, the word popped out of your mouth, environment. So if you think about this from the point of view of environmentalism, I mean, okay, what are the ways in which the Western world has gotten itself into this pickle, this environmental pickle that we're in? Well, part of the way is by not seeing how everything connects to everything else. I mean, I keep thinking, why in the world did they conclude it was okay to create these nuclear reactors up at Hanford next to the Columbia River, and that they could just shove this waste in the ground and it wasn't going to be a problem? I mean, what kind of mentality was involved in that when there's this entire world downstream of this river, including Portland, among other things, and then the whole ocean? I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, we're thinking about that because, you know, we're thinking about what's going on in Japan with Fukushima. But, you know, 1940s, yeah, okay, they're freaked out about the war. And, you know, we have to get the A-bomb before the Germans get the A-bomb. And that's a lot of what was going on. And that was not unrealistic. I understand all of what that was about. But, I mean, you got to look at these people who were so smart that they were stupid. That, and it's like, this is a great place to put it, right next to this river. Well, of course, because they needed all the water. But wait a minute. Think about the consequences of what you're doing. Think about how all the pieces fit together. No, they're not thinking about how all the pieces fit together. And it's true, there's a lot they didn't understand about radiation. But they already knew that there were going to be incredibly toxic byproducts of what they were doing. That wasn't new news to them, you know. I was like, well, okay. You know, there might have been alternatives that they should have been thinking about. And now, I mean, Hanford, like Fukushima, is going to be with us forever. They have no idea how to clean that mess up and the consequences of that. And the stuff that's buried and leaching through the groundwater into the, I mean, you know, talk with Shelley Simone about this, who's really expert, you know, turn your nails back on themselves and your skin white to hear what she has to say. It's just, it's unbelievable, you know. Well, I don't want to go down that line. That's not really my point here. But we will also talk about environmental issues, and I'd like to talk about cooking, too, as a sort of practice to develop some understandings of interdependence, because that's one of the ways that I learned was from working in the kitchen in Green Gulch Zen Center. It was a great opportunity to study interdependence. So these are some of the things I want to talk about. Okay? Turn it off, you think? Have a break?
Just one final thing on the four, on the cessation of suffering, that's the Eightfold Path, right?
The method for bringing about the cessation. Yeah. Right, because the Eightfold Path it could be understood as the causes of cessation, right? For example, if you're suffering because you told lies, then not telling lies will end that kind of suffering. I mean, because truthfulness is in there. Right, and lying creates pain, you know. Or, you know, there are a number of other possibilities, but yeah.
But given time.
Well, right.
Because some things are still working.
That's right, because if causes have been laid down through certain set of actions, then the question is, how do you ameliorate those causes? And there actually are techniques for doing that. But if you don't ameliorate those causes, they will produce effects. They will have an outcome.
Yeah, I was just thinking of someone who told a bunch of destructive lies, for instance. Even if they stopped telling lies, there would still be some residue from those lies floating around. Right?
That's right. And so in the Buddhist tradition, if you really don't want those lies to produce effects, you have to deal with what that means. And usually what that means is going back to the person to whom you told the lie and sorting that out with some degree of honesty and compassion. It might be something like, you lied to your boss because the project was not going to be done on time. I'm not looking at you, I just happen to be looking in this direction. You lied to the boss. I have to be specific here. You lied to the boss because the project's not going to be done on time. And, you know, then the project got done on time, and so there's no consequence. But the problem is you lied to your boss anyway. And now there's this thing that exists between the two of you. The boss doesn't know you lied, but you know you lied. So now you're uncomfortable around this person at some degree. And so how are you going to solve this problem? Well, the Buddhist point of view, the way you solve this problem is you go to your boss and say, look, I was really worried that this project wasn't going to get done on time, and I knew how important it was. So I told you it was going to get done in time, even though I didn't really believe it. But it did get done in time, but I wanted to clear the air with you. And then hopefully your boss says something like, it got done in time, and I appreciate you cleared the air with me. Don't ever do it again, but you're not fired.
But that's like on the very, like, Satchiji was talking about a lot about those five skandhas in regards to this pyramid, where there's this ordinary reality where the ego is at the point of the pyramid. It's very small. There's this consciousness reality down that makes up the base of this pyramid, and the other skandhas along the way, the energy and everything. And it just makes me think that, oh God, I didn't lose that thought.
You're thinking about the subtle.
Thank you. The subtle. That's where I was going. I just lost it from. Yeah. So that's dealing with it on the coarse level, the point of the pyramid to go talk to your boss, right? And but what the tantric practice that we do is about, the tantric practice that we do is about transforming it on the subtle level. So when you arrive, the whole idea about when you arise as Grimkara, or as Vajrasattva, or Shakyamuni Buddha. And then you look at from that perspective, which is ideally this perspective of this consciousness where we're all interconnected. And then you work with transforming that lie. Like you could visualize yourself as green Tara and your boss in front of you and saying to that person, you know, that I lie. Or you can visualize yourself in front of you saying, you know, this person. One technique is to put yourself in front of yourself as a Buddha, your ordinary self, in front of yourself as the Buddha, and to imagine yourself as the Buddha giving, you know, sending out goddesses with elixir, with a potion, you know, that will go through your ordinary self that will help relieve that energy and transform it into, you know, something that's positive, relieve the aspect of lying, transform it into something that's positive. So that's, you know, there are many, many, many techniques when you get a little more deeply into the tantras where you're working with that very subtle level. Because that's what happens, they say, you know, just before enlightenment, there's all these different steps to enlightenment. And at the very, when you're getting really close, what you're left with are these very, very subtle habit patterns. The coarse ones are gone. You know, like you wouldn't notice it. You know, like in somebody's everyday life, let's say that, you know, that person is a saint. But on the very subtle level, there might still be residues, like Tom was talking about, of these negative habit patterns. And so the tantras, they found, the Buddhist practitioners for centuries have found that those help alleviate the final boundaries or barriers to becoming the Buddha and work with those, right?
Right.
Yeah. So wherever we're talking about this stuff, you always got to. It really is helpful to think about that, you know, that one, when lots of times we're just talking from the ordinary level, you know, about what you can do as a practitioner, and that stuff's really important too, you know, to learn how to manipulate, or not manipulate, but what's the word?
Open up?
Yeah, or you know, function in the world in a way that's wholesome. But on the other hand, you know, we need to learn how to function on this subtle level too, to help transform.
Yeah, on Friday evening he talked about forgiving oneself, and he got into a deeper definition of what you're really doing when you're forgiving yourself.
Right.
But, and I have it written down probably, and maybe you guys remember, but he said, yes, I'm a human being, I'm not perfect. And then this extends to other people too, when you can forgive yourself, but just even with, if you're talking about your lying and all the effects it has upon you.
Right. That's a good one. That's a good one, too, is to practice with visualizing the person in front of you and saying that you forgive them. when you're in that state as a Buddha, that you forgive them and visualize them saying they forgive you. Because sometimes, you know, the people aren't around anymore.
Right.
They've passed away or whatever, so you can't really go up to them. You know, just so, but personally, for my, we did a lot of that practice in the 80s when I was at Zen Center, of doing the forgiveness meditation. And I found it incredibly helpful. It really did change things in a major way. And lots of times change relationships with people, you know, without me even saying anything to them. It did help even change, transform the relationship with that person, just doing it on that level, or just visualizing.
You do that in your meditations. You've done that a number of times. Picture adversary as
good point.
You. And I utilize that, and it's very
good.
Yeah, without even, you know, verbalizing forgiveness and I forgive you and you forgive me, but it comes about. The interconnectedness, really.
Right. Thank you for reminding me of that.
Yeah.
Yes, of course we've done
You haven't left that out.